I want you to just imagine a scenario for a second. You are miles away from the ocean, right? Like completely landlocked. And suddenly the water temperature off the coast rises by just a fraction of a degree. You don't feel it, you don't see it. But months later, that invisible shift in the ocean's thermal layers directly and mathematically causes a spike in human heart attacks.
Yeah, it's wild.
I mean, think about the sheer scale of that invisible thread. We are so used to treating environmental science and, human medicine as two completely isolated disciplines. You have ecologists in one building, cardiologists in another. But what if those systems are wired together so intimately that the migratory pattern of a fish swimming way out in the Pacific determines the rhythm of a human heart on land?
It is a stunning premise. You're looking at this multi-layered puzzle where global environmental ecology just crashes right into human epidemiology. The causal chain reaction is entirely invisible until you step back and look at the whole board.
Right. And mapping out that board is our mission for today's deep dive. We are tracking a hidden high-stakes chain reaction from global greenhouse gas emissions straight into the human cardiovascular system. And we are drawing all of this from a fascinating 2024 open access research article. It was published in the journal Facets.
Yeah, a really incredible piece of research.
It really is. The paper is titled "Potential Impacts of Reduced Seafood Consumption on Myocardial Infarction Among Coastal First Nations in British Columbia, Canada."
Okay, let's unpack this. We are focusing on a very specific demographic here, coastal First Nations in British Columbia, and we are tracking instances of myocardial infarction, which is essentially heart attacks.
Right, exactly. And to even begin to understand how ocean temperatures dictate cardiac events, we have to look really closely at the biological machinery inside this specific population. Because for millennia, the traditional diet for coastal First Nations in BC has been deeply, deeply anchored in marine ecosystems.
Which makes sense given where they live. Yeah. But we aren't just talking about, grabbing a fish for dinner. This is a highly specialized, continuous intake of very specific nutrients. And the main characters here are polyunsaturated omega-3 fatty acids. You have likely seen them labeled on supplement bottles as EPA and DHA.
Oh yeah, those acronyms are everywhere in the health world. Usually they're touted as some like miracle supplement.
Right.
But if we strip away the marketing for a second, mechanistically, what are EPA and DHA actually doing when they enter the human bloodstream?
Well, it really comes down to cellular architecture and biological signaling. EPA and DHA are structural fats. So when you consume them, your body physically incorporates them into the membranes of your cells. And because of their molecular shape, there are these highly flexible chains, they make your cell membranes much more fluid.
Okay, so they change the actual physical makeup of the cells.
Exactly. And in the cardiovascular system, they act as powerful biological mediators. They actively lower plasma triglycerides, which are, fats in the blood that can harden your arteries over time. And they also inhibit platelet aggregation.
Meaning they stop the blood cells from getting too sticky, like clumping together to form a clot.
Precisely the opposite of a clot, yeah. They keep the blood flowing smoothly, and they drastically reduce inflammatory markers that would otherwise damage the endothelial lining, which is the inner wall of your blood vessels.
Okay, so it's essentially like running a really high-grade, friction-reducing synthetic oil through a car engine. It just keeps the entire circulatory system pliable and clear.
That's a great way to look at it, yeah.
But anytime we talk about marine diets, especially today, there is a giant biological catch. Because the ocean isn't a pristine vitamin factory anymore, right? Right alongside those cardioprotective omega-3s, you are pulling up heavy metals, specifically methylmercury.
Yeah, methylmercury, or MAHG, is a highly pervasive environmental contaminant. It bioaccumulates, which means it gets more and more concentrated the higher you go up the food web. And its effect on the human heart is practically the dark mirror of everything those omega-3s are trying to accomplish.
Really? How so? Walk us through the actual physical damage it causes.
Well, where omega-3s reduce inflammation and protect the cell lining, methylmercury induces something called oxidative stress. It generates free radicals.
Which are the unstable molecules, right?
Right. Highly unstable molecules that just run around stealing electrons from healthy cells. And in the blood vessels, this oxidative stress acts almost like microscopic sandpaper. It damages those smooth arterial walls, which promotes the buildup of plaque, increases your blood pressure, and ultimately restricts blood flow. And that restriction leads directly to ischemic heart diseases.
Wow. Okay. So it's this massive internal tug of war, like a biological set of scales. Every single time a person in these coastal communities sits down to eat a piece of traditional seafood, they are putting an incredible cardiovascular protector into their body, but they are also introducing a contaminant that actively degrades the heart.
Exactly.
But I have a pushback here. If they're eating a lot of fish, shouldn't the mercury cancel out the heart benefits eventually? I mean, sheer volume alone.
What's fascinating here is that the researchers found the complete opposite to be true for this specific population. The data reveals a very, very unique dietary dynamic. The First Nations men in this study, they consume roughly 78 grams of traditional seafood daily.
Okay.
And the women consume about 50 grams. Yet, their daily intake of methylmercury is incredibly minute. We are looking at an average of only 5.1 micrograms per day for the men.
Wait, a microgram is already a millionth of a gram? But without a comparison, it's hard to grasp if 5.1 is actually low in the context of a heavy marine diet. Like, what's the baseline?
Right, so let's compare to Inuit populations up in the Canadian Arctic. The Inuit also have a diet deeply rooted in marine life, lots of marine mammals and fish.
Yeah.
But the methylmercury intake for the coastal BC First Nations is roughly 7.5 to 8 times lower than what you see in the Arctic.
Wow. 7 to 8 times lower.
Yeah. So because their mercury exposure remains so uniquely low, the omega-3s are just winning that biological tug of war by an absolute landslide. They are reaping all the cardiovascular protection without hitting the toxic threshold of the heavy metals.
And the historical medical records actually back that up, right? For a long time, mortality from cardiovascular disease in these First Nations communities was lower than the general Canadian population.
That's right.
That omega-3 engine oil was doing its job perfectly. But the entire premise of the study we are looking at is that this localized health advantage is vanishing. Today, the rates for ischemic heart diseases on BC reserves are 25% higher than the rates among other residents in the province.
Yeah. And the overarching question of the research is, well, why? We have this beautifully functioning biological mechanism, a diet uniquely balanced to protect the heart. But what happens when the external environment destabilizes that supply line?
Right. Which moves us from the human bloodstream out into the Pacific Ocean. So the study projects what this seafood catch is going to look like by the year 2050. And they didn't just, you know, guess. They used two massive climate models. And they refer to them as RCP 2.6 and RCP 8.5. For anyone who doesn't spend their day reading dense IPCC climate reports, could you decode those scenarios for us?
Sure. So RCP stands for Representative Concentration Pathway. It's essentially a way for scientists to model different possible futures based on human behavior. So RCP 2.6 is the highly optimistic strong mitigation scenario.
Like if we actually fix things.
Exactly. It assumes humanity gets its act together, drastically cuts greenhouse gas emissions, and limits global warming. But even in that best-case scenario, the models project a 21% decline in seafood availability for these communities by 2050 relative to the year 2000.
Yeah, 21% decline. So a fifth of the food supply is just gone, even if we do everything right.
Yeah. And then you have RCP 8.5, which is often called the business-as-usual pathway. This assumes we just keep burning fossil fuels at high rates, emissions continue to climb, and the oceans take the brunt of the heat. Under that trajectory, we're looking at a 31% decline in available seafood.
31%. Okay, but before we get into the biological fallout of a 31% drop, I really need to understand how the researchers establish their baseline. I mean, you can't just walk up to someone on the street and ask, hey, exactly how many micrograms of mercury did you ingest over the last 3 months? People just do not know that. How did they actually measure the starting line for this data?
They utilize data from the First Nations Food, Nutrition, and Environment Study. And the methodology is incredibly clever.
Mm-hmm.
They analyzed 369 randomly selected participants across 6 different coastal communities. And to get an accurate reading of mercury exposure, they didn't just rely on dietary questionnaires because, like you said, those are flawed.
Right.
Instead, they took small bundles of hair from the participants.
Wait, hair? Why hair instead of a standard blood draw?
Because hair grows at a remarkably predictable rate. It's about 1 centimeter per month. As the keratin forms at the scalp, it traps biomarkers, including heavy metals like methylmercury, straight from the bloodstream. So the researchers took these hair samples, laid them flat, and cut them into precise 1 centimeter segments starting from the root.
Oh, wow.
And by analyzing the mercury content segment by segment, they effectively read a 3-month historical ticker tape of the person's exact mercury exposure.
That is brilliant. It's like counting the rings of a tree, but for a human diet. So they have this rock-solid baseline of what people are eating and absorbing today. But how do you calculate a 31% drop 30 years from now? The ocean isn't a static bond. Predicting where fish will swim decades from now seems computationally impossible.
It does require a staggering amount of data processing. The researchers applied a framework known as the Dynamic Bioclimate Envelope Model, or DBEM. So picture a massive three-dimensional grid laid over all the world's oceans. For every single cell in that grid, the DBEM calculates the changing physical properties of the water under those RCP carbon scenarios.
Okay.
It factors in sea surface temperature, the temperature at the ocean floor, salinity levels, oxygen concentration, and even shifting ocean currents.
So it's essentially recreating the exact physical environment of the future ocean.
Exactly. Then it takes 98 culturally and commercially important seafood species and maps their specific biological tolerances against that shifting grid. So if the water in a specific grid cell gets half a degree warmer, does a species' metabolic rate spike? If the oxygen drops, does their habitat compress? The model accounts for how adult fish migrate to stay in their ideal temperature envelope, and even how changing currents will scatter their larvae.
Wow. So it's forcing the fish to literally chase their own survival conditions as those conditions move north or move deeper offshore. And when you run that massive simulation, the math spits out that 21 to 31% decline in catch for the BC coast. So the fish move or they die out. But how does that ecological gap jump species and cause a human heart attack?
Well, we return to our biological tug of war. The ocean modeling shows a massive drop in fish availability. Less fish means fewer omega-3s entering the human bloodstream. Now, you might think, well, they're also eating less mercury, so maybe it balances out. But remember the baseline.
Right. The mercury was already at the incredibly low 5.1 microgram level.
Right. Because the heavy metal intake was already negligible. Reducing it further offers almost zero additional protection for the blood vessels. But losing the massive daily influx of EPA and DHA structural fats, that is catastrophic. You are stripping away the synthetic oil from the engine, but you aren't removing any grit because the grit wasn't really there to begin with. The researchers took this nutrient deficit and ran it through epidemiological models to project the actual increase in myocardial infarction.
A direct translation from missing fish to failing hearts. So what are the actual numbers?
Under the climate models, the risk of a heart attack is projected to increase by 1.9 to 2.6% in men and 1.3 to 1.8% in women by 2050.
That's a significant jump across an entire population.
Yeah, and if we connect this to the bigger picture, the crisis isn't a flat rate across the community. The demographic data reveals a sharp vulnerability. Older individuals, those age 50 and above, are facing a projected 4.5 to 6.5% increased risk of a heart attack.
Wait, a 6.5% jump just from an ecological shift? Why is the older demographic absorbing so much more of the risk there?
It really boils down to dietary habits and cultural adherence. The elders consume the highest volume of traditional seafood, that 78 grams a day average we discussed earlier.
Right, right.
Their bodies are deeply accustomed to that high-level omega-3 cardiovascular shield. The younger generations are already undergoing a dietary shift. They're consuming less marine food anyway, so their baseline risk is already different. When the ocean warms and the fish vanish, the elders experience the most dramatic, sudden withdrawal of those essential fatty acids.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the modeling doesn't just treat fish as a generic monolith, right? The cardiac risk doesn't spike just because any random fish disappears. It is intrinsically tied to specific species.
Yes, the entire phenomenon is driven almost entirely by the fate of the salmon, specifically sockeye and Chinook salmon. For coastal First Nations, salmon are the ultimate cultural keystone species. And nutritionally, they're pelagic wanderers that pack on incredibly rich stores of fat, meaning they are the absolute dominant delivery system for those omega-3s. But the DDEM model shows salmon are acutely sensitive to the changing temperature and oxygen envelopes. The abundance of Chinook salmon alone is projected to plummet by nearly 37%.
Almost half. And compare that to halibut, which I think is the second most popular catch in these communities. Halibut are bottom feeders. They carry significantly more mercury and a fraction of the omega-3s compared to a Chinook. If the ocean model showed a massive die-off of halibut, the heart attack projections wouldn't jump nearly as much because the community wouldn't be losing their primary cardioprotective shield. It is the specific thermal sensitivity of the salmon that drives the human cardiac risk.
It is a brutal ecological irony. The single species most responsible for keeping their cardiovascular systems clear and healthy is the exact species most intolerant of a warming ocean.
Which leaves a massive gap on the dinner plate. If the salmon migrate north to find colder water and the catch drops by a third, people still have to eat. I mean, biology demands calories. What happens when the traditional food source dries up?
You trigger what epidemiologists call the nutrition transition. This is a documented phenomenon where indigenous populations, once they're cut off from nutrient-dense traditional diets, are forced to substitute those calories with commercially available market foods.
And the market foods available to them aren't exactly, you know, wild-caught organic greens. The study highlights that the replacements are typically heavily processed, energy-dense, and deeply lacking in structural nutrients.
Exactly. They are loaded with saturated trans fats, high sodium, and refined sugars. So consider the biological compound effect here. The environment strips away the EPA and DHA that were actively keeping the arterial walls flexible and reducing inflammation. In their place, the diet is flooded with trans fats and sugars, which actively promote arterial plaque, spike triglycerides, and accelerate the very oxidative stress the omega-3s were fighting against.
The environment takes away the shield, and the grocery store literally hands them a sword. But I have to ask the obvious question here. Indigenous communities are incredibly resourceful. They have adapted to local environmental shifts for thousands of years. If the salmon are moving deeper or further north, or if one species declines, why don't they just shift their traditional fishing practices? You know, change the gear, target different local species, adapt the harvest.
It's a logical assumption, but it ignores the reality of modern systemic constraints. The research is very clear that climate change is just the final pressure point in a much larger vise. The communities do not have unfettered access to adapt within their own territories. Participants in the study detailed how their ability to harvest is tightly suffocated by external factors. Government quotas and strict commercial fishery regulations limit what, when, and where they can catch.
So even if a different healthy species is present right off the coast, bureaucratic red tape might prevent them from legally harvesting enough to sustain the community's health.
Yes. And beyond the bureaucracy, you have massive industrial land use. Large-scale logging, mining operations, and oil and gas extraction have degraded local habitats. Logging roads have blocked access to traditional areas, and industrial runoff affects the local aquatic health. They can't simply follow the fish because their legal and physical mobility has been artificially boxed in.
Which brings us to the economics of that nutrition transition. The paper throws out a statistic that completely stops you in your tracks. 41% of on-reserve First Nations in British Columbia live in food insecure households. 41%. Compare that to the general BC population, which sits around 8.4%. You can't just tell someone in a remote coastal community to go buy high-quality, heart-healthy groceries when systemic poverty and exorbitant remote shipping prices make it mathematically impossible.
That is the crux of the crisis. The solutions proposed by the researchers aren't just about tweaking a carbon tax. They argue for systemic, multi-layered interventions. First, any climate adaptation programs must be fundamentally driven by indigenous knowledge and leadership. The communities know the local ecology better than anyone. They need the sovereignty to manage it.
Right. And the researchers also push for a hard pivot in how the fisheries are managed overall, moving away from maximizing commercial extraction and prioritizing local sustenance and ecosystem stability.
Yeah. And urgently, there has to be a structural intervention in market food affordability. If the climate models are accurate and some level of a nutrition transition is unavoidable, we have to ensure the replacement foods aren't actively toxic to cardiovascular health. It is a matter of immediate public health policy to subsidize or improve access to healthy alternatives in these remote areas.
We have mapped out an incredible, completely invisible chain of events today. We looked at how a reliance on fossil fuels traps heat in the atmosphere. That heat transfers into the oceans, shifting the delicate thermal and oxygen envelopes mapped out by those DBEM supercomputers. That shifting environment forces the sockeye and Chinook salmon out of their traditional waters, and the disappearance of that salmon rips away the primary dietary source of omega-3 fatty acids for coastal First Nations nutrients essential for keeping human arteries clear of plaque. And as those communities are forced by systemic poverty and industrial barriers to replace those lost fats with highly processed market foods, the rate of myocardial infarcts and spikes, particularly among the elders who relied on that traditional diet the most, I mean, from a smokestack to an ocean current to a salmon run, right into the chambers of a human heart.
This raises an important question, and it is something I want you listening right now to reflect on. We have just dissected a very specific, highly localized crisis where environmental shifts are quietly destroying the nutritional value of a community's food source. But ecological biology doesn't respect borders. Think about your own kitchen. How might subtle, unmeasured shifts in climate changes, in soil microbiomes, altered rainfall, rising temperatures be fundamentally rewriting the hidden nutritional profile of the crops and proteins you rely on every single day? Is the food on your plate already fundamentally different than it was a decade ago?
A very sobering thought to take to the grocery store next time. Thank you for coming along on this deep dive with us. Keep looking for the invisible threads connecting the world around you, because once you see how the systems are wired together, you can never look at a changing environment the same way again. We will catch you next time.